and saw basketball. But that's part of what took him to seminary and what brought him into the ordained ministry, a basketball scholarship. And, okay, you know, Luther had it happen in one way and Colden had it happen in another way. I've really appreciated Mark's ability to not only be a good thinker, but I've heard other people say they've appreciated your ability to communicate your thoughts, Mark. And I see you as a quiet teacher, but one who has a lot to share. And again, we're glad that you're with us.
I've been really glad to be here and get to know many of you and to be in on hearing the rest of the program, too. And right after Ruth Youngdahl Nelson spoke yesterday, we found a Murphy's Law for her. We're going to get this on tape. I can't find it in the book right now, but it says you can fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool Mom. The other one, the slide presentation we just watched, which ended with, you know, nothing stops a Swede. And this relates really, well, rather tangentially, but I got to back up a minute. I guess I see what the task of our studying or thinking about systematic theology, the task is, to help us organize and relate the various pieces of knowledge and expertise and concern that we have or need to have, to put it together so that it fits, or to see if we can't put it together that there's some things here that aren't fitting, that are working against what we really want to be about. And sometimes as we think in rather orderly or methodical ways, we begin to see some things that we had put together differently in a new way. And that was how I was going to relay this story. This guy saw something in a new way, but really I think he must have been Swedish and nothing stops a Swede. Now, he's rather well known in Montana, and the LCA pastors in Montana also have heard about this guy, some of you, but he, up in the Flathead Lake area, he's renowned as a great fisherman. Old guy. And apparently Swedish. And they got a new game warden coming in, and the old game warden said, I have never been able to catch this guy, but he's got to be doing something illegal because he catches so many fish. So before he finds out you're the game warden, why don't you see if you can catch him at this? And so the new game warden, not in uniform or anything, just kind of finds who the old guy is and sidles up to him and says, hey, old timer, I'm new here and I don't know much about fishing. You suppose you could teach me? And the old guy says, sure, come along. So the guy brings his rod and reel and puts it in the old timer's truck, and they drive up to a lake, and the old guy's got a boat there, and they get out, and the game warden gets all his fishing tackle, and the old guy just has a duffel bag. That's kind of strange, but they go down the boat and they roll out to the middle, and the old guy takes a couple sticks of dynamite out of his duffel bag and he lights them and throws them in the lake, and there's this mighty explosion and the fish come up all over the place, and the old guy grabs a gunny sack and starts filling it with fish. The game warden's just beside himself. He says, that's illegal, don't you know that? And the guy just keeps scooping up the fish, and finally he says, I'm the game warden and I'm going to arrest you. The guy keeps scooping up the fish. And the game warden's just getting more and more excited. And finally he says, I'm the game warden. I'm going to arrest you. That's illegal. You can't do that. What are you going to do about that? Finally, the old guy stops scooping up the fish. He reaches down the bag, lights another stick of dynamite, and throws it to the game warden, who catches it like that. And it's burning. And the old guy says, well, you're going to sit there all day, or you're going to fish? Ha ha ha! Anyway, I won't try to relate that anymore. Yesterday, I tried to deal with both the doctrines of sin and creation and talk about how in some way, some of our usual ways of looking at them, they may be liabilities, and how really I think they are and ought to be assets. If we interpret them in accord with Luther, and somebody reminded me that really I was pointing to assets that are rooted in Luther, may not be so prevalent in Lutheranism, but we'll see. Now, I don't think everything in the Lutheran heritage is this sort of either or. It can either be an asset or a liability. There's parts of our heritage, I think, that have been unfortunately ending us up ending up as liabilities over and over again. So many times our emphasis that we take there to be on the primacy of Scripture has led us into all sorts of theories about Scripture and bolstering these up into theories of inerrancy and verbal inspiration that seem to me utterly ahistorical. And these are liabilities because we live at a time when we're very much aware of the historical conditionedness of everything, including ourselves and our faith and our religion. And that kind of static view of the Bible relates to a static view of God all too often. Now, some of these groups that hold such positions have a sort of intensity for a while, but it seems to me that they're preoccupied about side issues, or they're majoring in minors, as somebody said. A second thing that's been prevalent in much Lutheranism, but not so much perhaps with us, is that, and I think it's a liability, those who have a particularly high view of the church and its ministry as having some special authority which sets the ministry and the church above the rest of creation. It seems to me to be a liability. Henry Horn used to speak about pastors who were like this as being fixated at the acolyte stage. And I guess I don't see that kind of authoritarian church and ministry as having much to offer in the future. And I'd add certain kinds of legalistic, pietistic groups who are mostly concerned with separating converted from unconverted, and certain sorts of neo-Pentecostals who value spiritual experience above ordinary experience as liabilities. And they all seem to me to exhibit some kind of a retreat from what those of us who are concerned about what's going to happen in the next, in the immediate future, as well as the eternal future, must be interested in, or we wouldn't be here. But those liabilities, if that's what they are, share an important trait in common in that they're all concerned about the unique identity of the church, or the Christian, or the Bible, the Christian message. And that is important, I think. And maybe those of us who grew up in congregations or traditions where there was so much emphasis on the unique identity that we've rebelled against it, have failed to put anything in its place. And so many of our people now are going off to little groups of one sort or another to find some unique identity. But it seems to me our uniqueness will not come in separating ourselves from the world and from non-Christians, because our uniqueness as Christians is something that's given to us. And all our theories about the Bible or our understandings of ministry or so forth are not the source of our uniqueness, but that is what we have received. And if we grasp at what we've received, clinging to it as some kind of a prize, that will be more like a temptation, like Adam's temptation. It seems to me our true identity will be found in handing on what we've received. Now, I'm not going to spend time on that, and I think I want to mention what I consider to be at least one of the clear-cut assets of our tradition that I think is reaffirmed every time you deal with an individual dying person, but you know, over and over again other times as well, the importance of the justification of the ungodly by grace through faith. You know, I think it's right that we say that this is central. This is what the church stands and falls on. It's not just one important item among others, as I hear in various ecumenical discussions, but it is the central focus that organizes all the others, justification. And, you know, surely we may have to do some reinterpreting here, because I don't think guilt under the law is the major category by which we understand our bondage anymore. But the central point is still utterly relevant. And I hope it informs, everything else I'm saying here. But it seems to me where things are less clear, whether the liabilities or assets are in some other areas, and we need to therefore be discussing these areas that are less clear. And I want to talk a little bit about the doctrine of the church and about living as a Christian in the world. And I think these are problems for most Christian groups today. What are the nature and purpose of the church, and how does one live as a Christian? What does that mean? And we have not often led the way in this kind of thinking, but I think we have some materials in our heritage that can be helpful here. I want to cover a little bit of ground. I'll try to cover it rapidly. Because when we think about the church, it's interesting to note that prior to the 4th century, when Christianity became established, there was an astonishing multiplicity of forms of the church, and this seems to have existed without leading to the sort of lack of unity that we might expect from multiplicity of forms. Perhaps it led them to a clearer sense of what was central and what things were not central and therefore could be organized in a variety of ways. But in any case, the multiplicity didn't last. And from the time, during the 1200 years or so between the establishment of the church and the Reformation, there was an increasing growth in uniformity and an increasing intolerance of diverse forms. And much of this was centered, this uniformity was centered on the structure of the church itself and on the priestly ministry or the validity of its ministry. And yet outside of some attention being paid to one holy, Catholic, and apostolic as the marks of the church mentioned in the creeds, the doctrine of the church didn't really attain central importance until after the reformers challenged it by claiming to be true churches. You know, there'd been a good deal written about priesthood and pope, but not nearly as much about the church. And the Reformation's challenge in this area, it seemed to me, came right there. You can't properly understand the ministry until you've understood the church. The church is prior to the ministry. And so what is the church? And we know how they answered. The Lutheran said it's the congregation of believers among whom the gospel is preached and the sacraments are dished out. That's literally what they said. We use such holy words about that, I think. And the Reformed tradition said nearly the same thing. Calvin in the Institutes quotes Luther, but then often they go on to add one more thing about the believers living a life of discipleship. But there's no mention of the clergy or the ministry. The emphasis is all on God's grace and our reception of it. And we realize that, I think. Now, Luther, if we think about it a minute, didn't set out to come up with a new definition of the church. He was overwhelmed by discovering a new view of God that was in contrast with the view of God and everything that followed from it that he had been taught, or that he had learned at least, whatever he'd been taught. He was overwhelmed in discovering God as forgiving, merciful, loving, justifying. Or as he put it, he was overwhelmed when he finally was able to make the distinction between law and gospel, or law and grace. And that what God was about was not only demanding from him, but giving him something and making him something. And we know that. But the point is that this message was the basis for any reforms that he went on to make. And that's also the source, that fact, that the message is first and the forms are later, is what I take to be a real asset in our Lutheran heritage of thinking about the church. Because it says that the content of the message and not the form of the church is most important. Now, I like to work with an old distinction between church type and sect type that comes out of Trelche's work of 70, 80 years ago. In terms of those types that say all Christian groups just about are either church type or sect type, I think Lutheranism is neither, or ought to be committed to neither. Now, in these ideal types, and I'm going to just look at them closely enough to critique them, the church type is a type of Christian grouping that makes its appeal for legitimacy or for rightness to the fact of its continuity through the centuries, in ministry or in doctrine or in structure, whatever. you know, apostolic succession or whatever. There's a very strong emphasis here on tradition, what has been handed down through the ages and faithfully continued and developed even now into the present. We take it all seriously in this position. And now there are many Lutheran churches, especially European state churches, that identify themselves or understand themselves in this way. But I don't think Lutheran theology commits us to this. I hope not. Because this is a position which is tied to the past and often to a fictitious version or a version of the past that is fictitious. It's very clear in the election of the last popes when the commentators who really know nothing, you know, the news commentators, are always talking about Peter's successor. I mean, no good Catholic thinks that anymore, you know, in terms of they're actually being able to show continuity back to Peter as the first pope. But that's what I mean, that this kind of churchliness is usually tied to a fictitious view of the past that reconstructs some kind of past to justify what we've come to be in the present. And it's usually also tied to the status quo. It's very closely identified with the society in which it's evolved. It's very difficult to be prophetic. And I think it can hardly serve us as the only model or understanding for the church in an age such as ours, which is rightly skeptical of all merely inherited authority and forms. Now the other type, the sect-type Christian group, as Trelch called them, sect in his terminology, being merely descriptive, separatist, not negative as we usually use it, refers to Christians who seek to restore in place of the existing church the true biblical form of the church. Because the church that has evolved over the years has been corrupt, it has not progressed, it has gotten worse and worse. They have an emphasis on conversion and on purity of life, and purity of doctrine, emphasis on the Bible, usually connected with an anti-clericalism. It's often strongly otherworldly, futuristic in the eschatological sense alone. Now, there's much in Lutheran history, again, that sounds familiar here. That we in much of our American Protestantism as well, have been anti-established church and back to the Bible. You can see this in the anti-Catholicism of so many Lutherans still, and the appeal we make to Scripture alone, our individualism, personal faith orientation. There's some real strengths here, we all know. Someone has talked about this as the joy of sects. But for all that joy, I think the weaknesses of that approach to a church are decisive. If you just think about it, there is no one single form of the church in the New Testament. Just look at all the denominations claiming to be, you know. But read Ernst Käsemann or anybody who talks about all the images of the church in the New Testament. And some of these are quite exclusive of others. So to say that we are going to base our form of the church or doctrine of the church on the New Testament and ignore 1900 years of church history is not only uncritical but impossible, I think. That position is also tied to the past, though in a little different way and to a slightly different past. And though this kind of position has a very strong prophetic voice sometimes, you know, the Bible as the source of renewal and reform, it seems to me it's unable to take the present or what has come into being since the New Testament or what will come into being in the next decades and centuries as into account in its thinking as significant places where God is also at work. We can't, you know, if you're really tied to the New Testament as your only source of any kind of information in making your theological understanding work, you can't, for example, accept modern psychological insights in dealing with people. You have to show Jesus as the great psychologist and read the stuff back in and then pull it back out, which it seems to me is simply dishonest. And it leads us to think that God only operates in the New Testament, whereas our confessions would say that he reveals himself decisively there, but not that he ceased to work after the New Testament. Now, we can all quote places where Martin Luther would seem to be appealing to the church type or to the sect type, and we can all find our Luther and put him in one of those slots wherever we'd like him to be. But the fact that we can quote him in every direction, I think, shows that he's not locked into either place. He appeals to the church fathers. He denies he was an innovator. He's a conservative reformer. Other places, he appeals to Scripture to throw out all kinds of stuff in a very iconoclastic way. But it seems to me we don't want to put Luther in either of those categories. If the content of the message of the gospel, as it strikes believers in the present, is for him prior to any form of the church, then I think it's proper to say that in the area of the doctrine of the church, Luther was an evangelical pragmatist. Now, you could say that about some other reformers too, especially John Wesley, I think. But for the moment, in this context, let's talk about Luther. To be an evangelical pragmatist in the area of the doctrine of the church is to say that whatever forms serve the gospel can and should be used. Therefore, unlike some of the other reformers, Luther retained, as we know, all kinds of Roman Catholic practices as long as, he said, they didn't hinder the faith of the believers, even if they weren't in the New Testament. But he was equally quick to throw things out in the name of the gospel, and hence, I think, was truly Protestant in that sense. Now, I think this evangelical pragmatism is a tremendous asset for us if we realize it. Firstly, because it's so flexible. It should mean that we're not tied to any single form or expression of the church or any single form or expression of ministry. It should certainly not demand uniformity or one form as a prerequisite for unity. I'm not sure what that means. We're going to have to shape that out, but on what basis do we make that? Those decisions. Secondly, shaping the forms of the church in the future, both Lutheran and in a wider sense, along the lines of being evangelical pragmatist, would mean that we'd be open to new information and insights wherever they come from. If someone gets some structures that work that we discover serve the propagation of the gospel, we can use them, whether they're Christian or secular. We're open to that. And thirdly, to be an evangelical pragmatist, I think, is to be responsible. It is to say that the forms are not given once for all, and so they must be reformed and rethought and redone. The church is always reforming itself. In every generation, we have some responsibility here. Now, there are potential dangers with that kind of stuff. You can hear, I'm sure you're listing them already. Because no particular form has been required among Lutherans, we've often been very sloppy, just taken whatever was there, borrowed uncritically, not paid much attention to our forms. I read a sign on somebody's wall yesterday that said something about the day before I came here, that said something about a hit or miss method usually misses. And in the area of the doctrine of the church, where we rightfully have said we're not tied to one single form, we've sort of said, well, it doesn't matter then. That's a kind of practical error, and we ought to be able to deal with that. But perhaps the tendency is for the forms, has been with us, for forms that were at one time established for good pragmatic reasons, they serve the gospel, have tended to remain with us for non-pragmatic reasons. And they've ceased to be useful. You can probably think of some forms here or where you've had to change because what was given was no longer useful. Or worse, we've got evangelical pragmatism and evangelical drops out and all we've got is pragmatism. Whatever works is good. And we open the door to all sorts of people who have techniques. Thinking of Norman Vincent Peale here, and in that regard, I thought we need to remember the pastor who found Paul appealing and Peale appalling. But, you know, we can't just borrow uncritically. Whatever works, we'll use, because it doesn't all serve the gospel or our understanding of the Christian message. So it seems to me, as Lutheran Christians, we need to build on and develop this notion of the fact that we are evangelical pragmatists, especially now as change becomes more rapid. And as the pluralism in our world, and after last night, in our universe, I mean, if we think we got pluralism now, what in the world is going to happen if we get some more planets involved here? You know, it's going to demand more diverse forms, forms we've never heard of, never thought of, can't possibly conceive of yet, if we're going to serve the gospel. Now, this is not a call to throw out everything we have had previously. And I think when we're in our 20s and we hear this, most of us here when we were in our 20s and heard this kind of language, and especially at some times in history, I was in my 20s in the 60s, and you'd put those two things together, and this is a call to throw out everything that happened before 19-whatever the year was. I think it's right that we speak of Luther as a conserving, if not a conservative, reformer. And I think much of American Protestantism particularly has been impoverished by its loss of what Tillich used to call the Catholic substance. It seems to me a truly evangelical pragmatism will hang on to the values and the traditional forms and practices, but will hang on to them for the right reasons and not just because they were there. Just because something is ancient doesn't make it either bad or good. Now, we have people in our circles that think because something is ancient, it's good. And we all know what that can lead to. But we also have people that think because it's old, it's bad. Either of those is uncritical. And I guess I would tend to be a bit cautious to err on the side of retaining the old and give what has been done effectively already the benefit of the doubt, other things being equal, and not throw stuff out before I had something to put in its place. And I think that's not just a personal preference. It seems to me it's in accord with Lutheran theology's insistence, because of its understanding of sin, that order is better than chaos, even if the order is inefficient or relatively less just or whatever, that some order is better than no order at all. In other words, I think an evangelical pragmatist would value tradition without becoming a traditionalist. And somebody, I suppose this is so old, nobody can be given credit for it, but I still think it's helpful for me in learning to value tradition. It's the quote that says, tradition is the living faith of dead people. Traditionalism is the dead faith of living people. And I think that distinction needs to be made. The tradition, what has been handed to us, you know, has great value, but we can't accept it uncritically. Now, difficulty that we as Lutherans and a lot of other Christians have inherited in this regard is that the Reformers, for one reason or another, never really questioned whether the parish structure or the local congregation was the only or the most important form of the church. The parish or congregational structure, the resident group, was there. It was presupposed by them. They tinkered with parts of it, of course. But basically, they simply assumed it and took it over. And there were many reasons for that. There were great advantages. They got to the grassroots that way. They bypassed some of the hierarchy. It was workable. The local parish structure had people's fear, if not their loyalty. And they could move with the Reformation's message then, and it fit in that kind of a society. Parenthetically, Walter Capps's little book, Time Invades the Cathedral, has some vivid images about how that parish structure once functioned in a really viable and valuable way, and how now that time, as he puts it, time has invaded the cathedral, all kinds of new things are entering in that we used to have to take into account. Now, it wasn't that the reformers were uncritical of other forms of the church. You know, they criticized the monastic movement for good theological reasons and emptied the monasteries. criticized the hierarchical view of the ministry for theological reasons, and they modified it at least. And they modified it quite radically in many places. But for some reason, the parish structure was altered in some ways, but not radically criticized as it probably needed to be, because you can't assume any form just automatically without saying, how does this serve the gospel? Now, if they had begun seriously with the content of the Christian message, they would have raised some real strictures, I think, about the parish structure as the only important form of the church, or as the normative form of the church, and this would have been particularly in the area of mission to the world. They couldn't have done that, probably, in the 16th century. In a world where everyone was baptized and supposedly everyone had to go to Mass, and where the leaders of government and business and all the other institutions were members of the church and regularly heard the preaching of the law and the gospel, and where, as far as they knew, the gospel had been brought to the whole civilized world, or at least that they said that, you know, the church's mission would have been dealt with by that structure. But if that were ever the case, even then, it certainly hasn't been so for a long time. What resulted is that those groups in the years since the Reformation that saw the importance of mission in the world, I'm not defining that, I want to leave it kind of broad and inclusive at this point, those mission-oriented groups ended up having to be outside the church in so many ways. The Pietistic Mission Societies, for example, did far more than the much richer and more powerful state churches, or just, you know, in our day, countercultural Christians concerned about the reform of society or the renewal of the church or about liberation have had to, in many cases, move outside what we consider to be the forms of the church. And usually the organized church has been happy to see them go. But the problem when that happens is that these para-church groups have usually also suffered from a one-sided theology. In losing their identity with what's called the church. In Pietism, we virtually lose the article of creation and the article of the church, and stressing only salvation for individuals and a life of discipleship which gets separated from the world instead of anchors you back in it. And recent thinkers, it seems to me, have so stressed that the mission is God's mission to the whole world, that the church has scarcely had any function, and you end up falling in, or faith even has had hardly any function, you end up falling sometimes into an uncritical universalism in some of these traditions, or a secularism that doesn't take seriously the sinfulness, the fallenness of the world and its creatures, nor in many cases do such movements see the importance of the ministering to the body of believers. I think that happened to many people in the 60s. You found out, you know, everything was mission and there was no, nurture. And you can't live on that forever. In other words, I don't want to deny for a moment the importance, even for our day and for the years ahead, of the parish structure. Something like that, that ministers to the believers, it seems to me, is essential for people's well-being as we understand the gospel. But the risk of calling the parish structure the form of the church, as so many of us Lutherans have tended to do, risks making it an end in itself and isolating it from many other things that the message would tell us we ought to be about. When I was in seminary, Kent Knudsen, the former president of the ALC, was teaching. And he was a very serious person. He rarely smiled, and he was just, you know, his lectures were perfectly organized. You could follow everything. And you just never expected him to offend you or shock you, which worked in his favor then because he could so easily. But I still remember him pulling this old thing out, and he was teaching the course on the doctrine of the church, and of course, when you teach a course on something, that becomes the most important thing about theology, and we were all getting
this was in the early 60s when the church renewal literature was, and the church as an end in itself, or the church as the only vehicle of God's work and so forth, was very important to many of us in many, you know, in social action or liturgics or whatever. And he used to remind us that the church is like Noah's Ark. If it weren't for the storm on the outside, you couldn't stand the smell on the inside. And, you know, to realize that the church also is simul justus et peccator, because each person in it is important. Now, what's happened is that we've said that God is at work in the church, which is, I want to say, absolutely so, but then we've assumed that that means he's often assumed, some of us have often assumed that he's not at work elsewhere. But to say he's at work in the church doesn't mean he's not at work elsewhere. He's not at work in the same way. We may want to make a distinction. But he's at work unceasingly in his creation, as we talked about yesterday. So that simply to be alive means that we and all people encounter God unceasingly, but apart from the gospel. But I think that's important to say that. To be alive means to encounter God unceasingly, though apart from the gospel. The purpose, then, we could say, of the Christian ministry and mission is to bring the word of the gospel to the guilt or fear of death or preoccupation with ourselves or with this present moment under which all of us are laboring. And that was eloquently portrayed in the slide presentation just as it ended in the Swedish society. The gospel is to show us, in fact, that the old is old, that there is something new. But it's not the purpose of the gospel to remove us from the old, but to free us to use it properly, because God creates it too. Luther said, I was really surprised, and I don't have the reference here. I stole it from somebody. That the church exists for those who are not in it. He saw that even then. Now, later Lutheranism may have often forgotten this, but defining the church in that way, the church exists for those who are not in it, not yet in it. Defining it this way is those, we who receive and then give, we who gather and then scatter, to use 20th century language, where internal maintenance is always for the sake of external mission, seems to me to be a clear implication of the gospel of God's grace, and therefore a clear implication of thinking of the church in terms of evangelical pragmatism. But when we unthinkingly or unintentionally make the parish structure, the congregational structure, the only proper form of the church, we increase the likelihood that we'll make the church instead an end in itself. And especially for those of us who are its paid staff, I suppose we could defend our making the church an end in itself if, in fact, we were equipping the saints for their mission in the world. But the structures themselves seem to me to make my work over and over trying to get other people also to make the church an end in itself. Church work becomes the work done at the church instead of the work done as the church. Now, I'm not going to try to suggest new forms today. We need to do that. I'm talking about a theological base on which we could construct forms. So I want to go on to talk a little bit about what this means for living in the world, though it's quite connected with this, so that hopefully it won't take long. By not being very reflective or critical on how we've understood God to be acting, we've often, especially since Karl Barth, who influenced so many Lutherans in this country because he got translated early, we've often taken the redemptive work of God through the means of grace, now channeled through the institutional church, to be the only really important work that God does. That's what I talked a little bit about yesterday. But we should include also that creative work of God, which would mean that all people serve God in their lives in some way, whether they want to or not, whether they know it or not, And it would mean also that redemption would be seen by us as the completion and fulfilling of the creation, so that our lives as Christians would be both about the mission of proclaiming the good news, but also we would still continue with our other task of being a steward or a citizen of the whole creation, and that both those tasks are important to us. I'll keep come back to them. But we had one member that, well, for example, wouldn't it be better, or at least desirable, if we worked as hard to get members on the city council as on the church council? Or living in Helena, where all the state offices are, we had one of our good members who was on the building committee, building fundraising committee, who for about 2 months was working 16 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week, meeting with legislative committees in order to try to get additional funds for the Department of Institutions, in which he is, which does the prisons and the mental institutions and so forth, and missed all those building fund committee meetings and missed most of the worship services and all the Lenten services. And, you know, the tendency was to criticize this guy instead of recognizing the importance of his mission, and he was well aware of it. In other words, I think we've only paid lip service to Luther's injunctions that the scrub woman doing her job is as important as the preacher or the teacher. And deep down, though, none of us would admit to it, or none of us believe it. Don't we all act much of the time as if full-time Christian service is somehow better? It's a disease that affects you in seminary, I think. I don't know. It's the only way you can make it through, to think it's somehow better. But what would be the future of the earth if all Christians went into that sort of so-called full-time Christian service? You know, by not taking right into the heart of our message the doctrine of God's creative work, his ongoing work, and by not really exploring the mission or purpose of the church in terms implied by the gospel and the law, we've lost what Lutherans used to call the doctrine of vocation. The idea that our calling to be Christ's then restores us to and transforms our callings to be creatures. I think that doctrine has got all kinds of possibilities as long as we free it from the old thing about what the doctrine of vocation means is that you stay in your place. You were called to be a slave. You know? People have understood it that way if they had a static notion of God and his creative work. But I don't think that it's there at all. That the gospel is to let us know that we're creatures. It's good to be creatures, even as we defect from that. And then we can get on with our work. Now, to put it schematically, if Jesus had two main tasks, to preach the gospel or proclaim the kingdom of God on the one hand, and to serve on the other, so also we as his church have those tasks. But I think we need to see that the church's service is not primarily in an age of where institutions are suspect and inefficient and so forth, is not going to be primarily our corporate service in the world, but in the vocations of Christians, individuals and groups. Vingren says in Gospel and Church, it is men and women in their places of work, or we could, in the places they live, who are the church. It's important to say, but it's really hard to help people to see that if we don't believe it ourselves. So I want to talk a little bit, in closing now, about the doctrine of vocation. When we learned it in seminary, those of us who learned it in seminary or heard about it someplace, it was usually linked to the first article of the creed and the law. Our calling is the place where we eat bread by the sweat of our brow. Our vocation is the place where God lays obligations on us, you know, to serve our family and to serve our world. And the arena where God compels us, we have to work, you know, we have to do this. And how does this relate to the gospel? That's the sort of traditional way. How does that relate to being made new? To there being really something new happen? Paul said the gospel is the end of the law. For the new person, there is no law. The new person does good spontaneously. But we must be clear, and I think this is clear for Luther, but it was difficult for us to see it because we didn't have the biblical scholarship to back up his intuitions. The resurrection life is an eschatological reality. He used to call the gospel promise, the law and the promise, that this is a promised reality. We are righteous in Christ. We remain sinful, simultaneously sinful in this world while being righteous in Christ eschatologically. When the judgment comes, we will be forgiven. And thus the gospel should show us in this understanding that even in our vocation, where the law disciplines us and puts us to death slowly over our 70 years, even our vocation is part of God's love for us. It shows us that God's laws aim at the same thing that love engendered by the gospel aims at, caring for our neighbor. And because we still remain sinful, we need our vocation, which will make us serve others. But at the same time, our vocation, I'm not talking about our pastor vocation, but our calling wherever we are, and primarily outside the parish ministry, I suppose, I'm talking about the message we preach. In this vocation, at one and the same time, this is what's so interesting for me, at one and the same time, the old self is being disciplined, and the new self is exercising faith. If we are simultaneously old and new, the old is being disciplined, forced to love the neighbor, while the new self is exercising faith. Same sort of thing, that the ambiguity of our Christian existence. And this is how, I mean, that language about dying with Christ is not just a metaphor. This is how, it seems to me, the old is being crucified and the new is raised each day as life moves toward real physical death, which will be the final elimination of the old and the triumph of the new. And as Christians remain in our callings in the world, this will be our identity with the crucified Christ. Not in some religious act, but in some act for others. And as only the gospel explains the law, so only the church will make sense of this vocation. The newspapers, what did I read Sunday? I guess it was the Great Falls paper, talking about people whose jobs are all meaningless. And they will be unless they are clarified by the church. Because without the church, vocation wouldn't be our calling, but a form of condemnation unto death. So, in closing, it'll be in the world, under the law, in the area of vocation, that the future of the earth will be worked out. And in our heritage, if we look at it closely, there are resources for freeing us from the world for the world. From the law, for the law. From the seeming meaninglessness of our work or vocations to our calling. From the church as an end to the church as a means. And at the same time, we realize, as the old saying has it, while humankind proposes, God disposes. So that our hope will lie not in our efforts alone, but also in, with, and under our efforts in God. And I wanted to close with a famous statement by Reinhold Niebuhr, which gets at this, I think, this orientation and this realism. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. Thanks a lot. We got time for coffee?